You are listening to a podcast from Raritan Valley Community College.
So, I'm Dan Aronson, a professor of economics at this college, and this presentation will discuss the results of my faculty research grant, which explore the potential to integrate environmental issues in the business curriculum. Let's start with some background. Standard economics depicts the economy existing apart from the material world, which is scientifically absurd. A scientifically realistic model would show valuable natural resources entering and waste leaving the economy. Depicting the economy in this realistic manner brings environmental concerns to the fore, rather than relegating them to a later chapter. Incorporating this scientific matter doesn't distract from the teaching of economics. It seamlessly integrates the two subjects. My faculty research grant explored the possibility that environmental considerations could be seamlessly integrated into other business courses. The creation of the Dow Jones Sustainability Index and requirements by major businesses for a green supply chain has created a market for environmental accounting. According to Ernst & Young, 95% of the largest 250 companies in the world produce a sustainability report. The number of S&P 500 and Fortune 500 companies issuing sustainability reports more than doubled from 2010 to 2011. But a couple of articles in accounting journals pointed out that even if individual firms utilize such accounting, economic growth could overwhelm progress at the firm level. That is, while environmental accounting might induce firms to invest in energy efficiency, overall economic growth could swamp this progress, causing total emissions to rise. Some experts argue that advances in efficiency in solar could trump economic growth. But this is a moot point because there is a striking increase in the market for goods and services that happen to cause production to decline. The National Association of Realtors published a study in 2013 on the strong growth in demand for real estate near public transit. Note that authorizing construction near transit would lead to a decrease in the production of automobiles. That is, if it's done on a mass scale. Also in 2013, the USDA issued a press release about the growing demand for urban agriculture. This increasingly desired agriculture not only reduces production and transportation, it also reduces the production of crops, as grain-fed livestock is not feasible for urban agriculture. Entrepreneurs would be in a better position to meet growing markets for real estate near transit and local agriculture if parking lots near transit were freed up for such purposes. This is not one professor's idea. New Jersey Future, an organization that cooperates with the New Jersey Builders Association, issued a report about the potential for building on parking lots by New Jersey transit stations. There is also a trend to use parking lots for local agriculture. It's unsurprising that the conversion of parking lots to agricultural plots would be promoted by business organizations. According to a Market Umbrella research paper, having a farmer's market nearby businesses in American cities means an increase in sales from $19,000 to $15 million. The obstacle that prevents parking lots from being put to all these profitable uses is the policy of subsidizing driving. This policy, by undermining alternatives to single occupancy vehicles, creates the need for parking lots. Ending the subsidies would resolve the problem. 2 points follow from the above ideas. First, The growing market for environmental accounting will require upper-level undergraduate courses to cover this topic. Therefore, the explanation of how economic growth could overwhelm environmental progress at the firm level should be addressed in economics, not only for its economics content, but to shed light on what accounting students will learn down the road. Second, while marketing texts briefly mention that policy changes can open up markets, thank you, Elaine Moore, for pointing that out to me, we can't expect marketing courses to dwell on the municipal parking reforms that would open up the growing markets for local agriculture and real estate near transit. Economics courses, however, should fulfill that role. Again, this matter should be covered not only for its pure economics content, but also for the strictly business point that local policy changes could open up major markets. To summarize, it may not be feasible to seamlessly integrate environmental matters into accounting and marketing courses, but for the sake of the teaching of those subjects, and not least for the sake of teaching economics, economics courses should cover the topics discussed above. It was mentioned earlier that meeting the demand for existing consumer preferences could lead to a decline in production, a scenario that would entail fewer work hours. Decreases in production and work time reduction go hand in hand. The only question is whether the work time reduction will be in the form of unemployment or shorter hours per worker. On that note, business education should emphasize that shorter hours increase hourly productivity. In a 1909 article, Princeton economics professor Sidney Chapman wrote, "I have found no instance in which an abbreviation of hours has resulted in a proportionate curtailment of output. For the Lancashire cotton industry, observations reaching back about three quarters of a century indicate that the beneficial effects wrought upon output by the shortening of hours were substantially repeated." During the Q&A, I could mention specific businesses that experienced dramatic increases in productivity after going to a 30-hour week. For now, I'll mention that a 2007 study of OECD countries found a strong correlation between reduced hours and higher productivity, thereby replicating Chapman's results. It's not surprising, therefore, that Mexican billionaire Carlos Slim and Google CEO Larry Page recently called for a substantial reduction in work time. If economics professors would take a cue from these business leaders, they would return to a historically important theme in their field. In 1848, John Stuart Mill wrote, "It is scarcely necessary to remark that the end of economic growth implies no end of growth of human improvement. In this state, technological progress would produce its legitimate effect, that of abridging labor." Mill also observed that growth without end would eventually destroy the natural world and with it all that makes life worth living. Work time issues are discussed in management courses, and while such courses should address the strong correlation between shorter hours and higher productivity, it's up to economics courses to cover the connection between shorter hours and the environment. It's all one of a piece, as John Stuart Mill revealed in 1848. The above ideas on the integration of environmental issues in the business curriculum lead to an intriguing result, namely the integration of the practical and the transcendent. Progressive intellectuals envision a world in which people reside near public transit, purchasing fresh produce from local farmers. And these goals can be realized by enabling businesses to respond to existing markets and existing values. Progressive intellectuals also envision a world of shorter work hours. At least they should envision that if they were capable of measuring up to Glenn Ricketts. Let me repeat. Progressive intellectuals also envision a world of shorter work hours. Currently, high household costs make shorter hours impractical. On that note, allowing entrepreneurs to build housing near transit by increasing the supply of housing would lower the cost of housing for future buyers. Residents of the new housing would also be spared some or the entire burden of automobile costs. In summary, permitting entrepreneurs to satisfy existing markets would make work time reduction more feasible. Standard capitalist policy can lead to a truly transcendent outcome. The point here is not to offer an unqualified defense of free market economics. The point is that opponents as well as supporters of free market economics could both agree that we should end perverse subsidies. Thank you. I left plenty of room for plenty of time for comments, no? I can't. Is that Andrea?
Yeah.
I you know what? Let me put my distance glasses on. Go ahead. Before I directly address your question, let me mention a couple of facts. There has been new residential construction in downtown Somerville near the train station. And by the way, they just authorized another area to be cleared for more construction near the Somerville train station. I once took the train out to Highbridge to do a presentation to the Rotary Club. And I saw some construction next to the train station in Annandale, way out in Hunterdon County, right? Now, that only partly addresses your question because not everybody can take the train every place. So on that note, there is a cutting-edge concept out there that makes possible effective transit despite suburban sprawl. It's a high-tech van service that uses GPS and software that instantaneously calculates optimal routes. It's a cross between a bus and a taxi. All right? And since I learned about this in 96, and for years I talked to my students about it as an academic concept. And 4 years ago, I went up to visit Yale University, which provides this service for their students. Now, Yale University is a private institution. They don't provide a service for the whole town of New Haven. We're a community college. Don't you think we should be the first to promote this service in our community and really increase access? You know, it's part of our mission for the community college. Well, a couple of people are nodding their heads. You know, don't all yell at once. Okay, I'm displaying such passion, and all you can do is nod your head a little bit. Thank you, Andre. I knew you wouldn't hesitate to express some energy. That's a compliment. Oh, yeah. Carl, speak up, please. Oh, and I agree with it 100%. That's what I teach in my classes.
and we can solve the ecological crisis.
I don't know if I said it was totally sufficient, but you know what? If I add a point, I would argue that that's indeed the case. But go ahead.
Okay, so basically, the way I understand Naomi Klein's argument is that capitalism requires growth, and therefore it's unsustainable, and that's why capitalism and fixing the climate are incompatible.
Right. Yeah, I can very directly address that. You know what? For the sake of the podcast, let me quickly say that you are asking me how I'm addressing Naomi Klein's argument that capitalism, because it's based upon expanding markets and growth, is compatible with saving the climate. Right? Now, why don't I begin by first repeating what I said before. There's definitely growing markets for real estate near transit and urban agriculture. If we just allow entrepreneurs to satisfy those markets, that would certainly help, and it would be associated with the decreases in production that I mentioned before. Now, that's not sufficient, by the way. Naomi Klein expressed reservations about imposing a modest carbon tax. All right, she said that a couple of times. In fact, the concept of a carbon tax is advocated by numerous advocates of free market economics. They say change the price, raise the price in effect, right? And then let the market work itself out. And it would do so beautifully. I remember the first OPEC oil embargo when energy prices skyrocketed. Between 73 and 1986, the economy grew while total energy use in this country remained constant, meaning energy use per person went down. I say, let's have an even bigger carbon tax. And by the way, that would enable entrepreneurs to satisfy the growing market for energy efficiency in buildings. Right now, people want energy efficiency. It just won't pay for itself because the price of fossil fuels just don't reflect their true cost. Do you see that? So I say let's have a really stiff, I guess it would have to be gradually implemented to some extent, right? Anybody would agree with that. But let's have a gargantuan tax on carbon. Again, entrepreneurs would meet that the existing growing demand and the accelerated growing demand for efficiency and solar. We'd have again, if we reduce subsidies for driving. We would reduce the market for automobiles. You do know that the millennials are buying far fewer automobiles than the baby boomers, right? So what I'm saying is we should meet existing demand. Now, I think that directly responds to you, but since nobody else is raising their hand for the moment, I wonder if you have a – remind me your name.
Tom.
I know. I'm sorry. Okay. You're not sitting in the usual place in the usual classroom. Okay. Go ahead. But speak up, Tom.
So this carbon tax, say if we did make all the houses energy efficient, we all started driving electric cars to avoid it, and everybody cut down their carbon emissions. This all requires still electricity, which is dependent on fossil fuels. So that would, the carbon tax would then have to be paid out by
I'm not so sure about that. There's plenty of patents out there. We already have substantial investments in energy efficiency. The oil companies can't stop that. Certainly the oil companies can lobby legislators who are clearly for sale. right? They should actually not be dressed in suits and ties since they're for sale, if you get my drift. But they can't, they don't have a lock on all the patents for energy efficiency. Now, on that note, let me mention something that I just noticed this morning while I was cleaning up my desk. Just happened to catch this. Electricity consumption, I don't know if this is per person or per annum, or the whole country, it's declining by 0.7% a year already. And if we impose a really stiff carbon tax, we could accelerate that decline. By the way, we don't just need more EVs. Again, we have to satisfy the existing demand for real estate near transit. You don't need an EV. You don't need a hybrid. You need your own two legs. And I can attest to you personally that when you walk to the bus stop or to the high-tech van service or to the train stop, you don't need your car. You'll be very happy. Okay, it gives you a lift for the whole day. Okay, Carl, you'll hold on to your thoughts because I do want to hear. You have more thoughts? But I mean, I'm sure we'll have time for them. I'm not saying it to be diplomatic. I want to hear from you. Megan. Is that where you live?
Yeah.
Oh.
In that area. So I do like that idea. My question is, because you are advocating for these environmental impacts, why are you suggesting building additional housing near transit? And I was particularly struck when you said they were clearing space in Somerville or wherever it was to add more housing, as opposed to expanding the transit infrastructure to places where housing already is.
You know what? If we stop subsidizing driving, you won't need a huge transit infrastructure. There'll be a market for simple carpooling, and you don't need any infrastructure for that, as well as the high-tech van service. I mean, you might need some nice stops. What's the word I'm looking for? Where you have an overhead and, you know, some heat in the winter, you know. Shelters, thank you very much. Saudi Arabia, by the way, has shelters with air conditioning outside. They must be solar powered, I guess. I wonder if Saudi Arabia acknowledges that there's solar power in their country. So out here in the suburbs, where a majority of Americans live in the suburbs, we don't necessarily need a lot more transportation infrastructure. And you know what? I forgot to repeat your point, which is that Megan was saying that I talked about building more housing near transit, but don't we have to build more transportation infrastructure? So hopefully. Let me repeat what you just said. Megan Dempsey was saying, let's bring more transportation to where the housing already exists. You know, there's an urban professor, urban planning professor at Rutgers, who points out the urban sprawl already exists. We can't completely reverse that. We can't necessarily do a Khmer Rouge in reverse. And that's where the high-tech van service comes in. That would solve the problem of having effective transit alternatives despite suburban sprawl. By the way, the link in Huntington County already has GPS. If they would only buy this software that instantaneously calculates optimal routes, Huntington County could be a pioneer. And by the way, more students, more folks in Huntington County could avail themselves of RVCC.
So my only concern about think the nature of employment, particularly in New Jersey, that's my own experience, doesn't make carpooling very feasible, or this high transit van you're talking about, because unless they were not going to sort of restrict the distances a particular van would travel, but most people are not, even students, are not staying in a very central geographic location that it sounds like that kind of service would provide. So are they going to bring people?
If you don't mind, I'm going to repeat what Megan said, that, you know, with this, with New Jersey spread out the way it is, she can't envision any transit service effectively doing the trick.
I mean, small scale, like you're talking about vans and
cars. Yeah. The transit service that I'm describing really would be for a county, a typical county. Now, on that note, in 96, Enzo Penzias, who was the Nobel Prize winner in physics, wrote a book in which he talked about how traffic is such a headache. And he described this high-tech van service. And he said, with queuing theory, with the advanced algorithms, you could link up services in different counties. So you do a quick transfer. Most people wouldn't want to do that, but, you know, on occasion you could. By the way, to make the service more appealing, you would authorize drivers of transit vehicles to make red lights go green. There's no reason why any transit vehicle should wait at a red light. And I'm still waiting for Carl's rejoinder. You know, when somebody's silent like that, you wonder if... but anyway, my imagination is running away with me. Tom, speak up, please.
So, I reaffirm that I do find it hard to, like, you know, wrap my head around the transit service, but, you know, New Jersey's the most densely populated state in America, so if there's any state that could do it, it's us. But still, it's hard to wrap your head around it. But then you think of a state, say, like Texas, which clearly has millions more people than us, but they're so much bigger. So, the logistics
My student Tom just pointed. What's your last name, by the way?
Masters.
My student Tom Masters.
No, Masters.
Masters pointed out that since New Jersey is the most densely populated state in the country, it would be appropriate for us to improve transit alternatives. So before, in response to Andrea Vaccaro, I pointed out that as a community college, as I should add, one of the most distinguished community colleges in the nation, we should take the lead on this. And Tom just reinforced the point by saying New Jersey should take the lead on it. You're absolutely correct. You said you're having trouble, you know, wrapping your minds around this. Most people are just not aware that driving is subsidized. And on that note, just last night, I watched the beginning of NJN News. There was a press conference yesterday. President of the New Jersey State Chamber of Commerce, along with a couple of union leaders, and William Dressel, the head of the League of New Jersey Municipalities, all declared we've got to start funding our transportation trust fund. And Bill Dressel said, look, this is a user tax, which Ronald Reagan called a user charge when he raised the gas tax. People don't realize that suburbanites are subsidized. Suburbanites are on welfare. They're in a cycle of dependency. We make the driving so cheap that it knocks out the alternatives. There are no alternatives. So if you say you got to pay your way and pay for driving, everybody howls, no, there's no alternatives. Greg, Glenn. Oh, I have a direct response. It's understood that in general in suburbia driving is subsidized, but let's not just talk in such generalities. In the late 90s, Charles Kamenoff, a Harvard-trained economist, did a large-scale study and found that, and he wasn't talking about externalities or carbon emissions. He just looked at the cost of maintenance of the roads and paying for safety, which I guess partly law enforcement personnel, partly signage, right? He said in New Jersey, on balance, it's subsidized. He found the same thing for New York State as well. Not at the state level, but at the local level through property taxes. So it's a positive, direct subsidy. And then if we consider that mandates for parking make housing more expensive because, you know, the opportunity cost of the land, that's a further subsidy. But that's not what Charles Kamenoff looked into. All right, so but I haven't found too many disputes of this argument that driving is subsidized. By the way, we're talking a lot here about transportation. Let me emphasize, this is not just about transportation. This is about housing. You know, we work without end to pay for housing. We could really increase the supply of housing here and make life much more affordable and much more bearable in New Jersey and the New York metropolitan area.
I wonder if we're going to have, as frequently, you know, you have sometimes social goods that people all around consider desirable that collide with each other. For example, in New Jersey, we have an affordable housing law that requires communities to build more housing than they would otherwise.
I know. I could speak to this on a personal level. I qualified for Mount Laurel Housing when I first taught here. So I got into housing, and to qualify, I had to make under a certain income. So I lived in Bedminster Hills, in the poor section, right? And I constantly had to get over to Somerville to get something to eat. I would much rather have preferred that we use a market-based approach, namely stop subsidizing driving, stop mandating parking lots. I wish I had lived or had the opportunity to live in housing in downtown Somerville near the train station and with a bus service to this college. Now, there's something else I want to mention. There's also the question of, you know, people don't want very high density housing necessarily. When I say people, I mean the existing residents, because if the influx of population and you have to start paying for school services and it gets very expensive. You once emailed me about that a long time ago. What I'm talking about here is a way to alleviate the property tax burden. Instead of taxing property, let's tax driving, and let's tax carbon. And ultimately, it will make life more affordable, and it will get us over that problem of if there's an influx of population, your property taxes go up. We really have to move away from property taxes. Susan. You know what? Susan Dorward pointed out that my project was about integrating environmental issues in the business curriculum, and she was asking, what is the state of affairs? Look, let me give you a partial response. This project caused me to have conversations with my colleagues. One conversation was with Elaine Moore, professor of marketing. In that conversation, she pointed out, incidentally, that the growing trends in marketing were health and wellness, environment, and mothers who do paid work. Two-income families. And, I mean, that largely summarizes so many of the things I just discussed. But economics texts don't emphasize these things that much. So I find it, I wouldn't have learned this if it wasn't for the faculty research grant, that at least marketing, they directly focus on some of these topics. They should be addressed in economics, and they're not. Let me add one other thing, two other things. For this research grant, I read our Intro to Business text, which I never would have done, you know, if it wasn't for the grant. I was shocked. In almost every chapter, they had multiple references to environmental issues. And multiple occasions they mentioned millennials don't want to work as many hours as the baby boomers. Moms who do paid work need either flexible hours or even shorter hours. These are basic economic issues that are hardly touched on in the economics texts, but they're discussed in the business texts. And the only other thing I wanted to mention is that I've had some really productive discussions with Ellen Lindemann about these issues. I have to further discuss these matters with my economics colleagues before I start discussing, you know, that further in public. Thank you for that question. Zach.
So to me, driving is a sense of freedom. How do you appeal to not drive to kids and my generation?
Zach said driving gives you a sense of freedom. How do I appeal to young people who want to have a sense of freedom, especially his generation? Your generation, the millennials, are driving much less and buying fewer cars than any recent generation. But speaking of that sense of freedom, under my scenario, if you drive, you'll pay for it, but you'll move. You'll actually move, right? But you'll let me tell you something else. You have a sense of freedom if you're not totally dependent upon automobiles. You have a sense of freedom if you're not working without end to pay for the high cost of insurance, which young people pay for. Right, and you can jump on a van and sail through red lights, as drivers of cars have to wait. Tom Mesters.
I mean, you're using the statistics to support your argument, but you don't look at where those statistics come from. The reason why we're buying less and less from the baby boomers was when the baby boomers come out, just as the name suggests, there were so many of them. Because, you know, right after World War II, everybody, you know, wanted more and more kids. But nowadays, if you look at the trends of population in the first world countries all around the world, the population, though increasing, is increasing much less. The world's populations are increasing in more, you know, I think you were in the term third world, but... You know,
the fertility rates are down. My student Tom Mester said that there's a smaller number of millennials, right? Now that I think about it, that's the echo boom. So it's not such a small number. I'm really talking about per thousands of population. I'm talking about percent of the population. All right. Millennials don't have to buy cars. They're moving to the cities or next to public transit. They just don't have to buy cars. They also might not.
They're still much younger than the baby boomers. Perhaps some baby boomers can afford three cars. I doubt for a millennial at this point with their student loans and their poor jobs and everything else. That's also a confounder.
Yeah, Andrea pointed out that millennials can't afford to buy cars. You know what? You're reminding me of another point. A lot of millennials, since they can't even afford to move out, are coming back home to their parents. And as a result, they don't have to work as much because they're not paying a mortgage. And for the most part, they're not paying rent, you know, those who live at home. So their bosses can't make it work crazy hours. That's just a separate point. Speaking of shorter hours, Naomi Klein did mention a shorter work week, which is essential for progress on the environment. One of my colleagues in the shorter work time movement, Charles Siegel, put it very simply. You work less, you're going to tend to consume less. All right? So that's essential for the environment. On that note, there are multiple surveys indicating that Americans not only want more free time, but it's a top priority. Frank Luntz, former Bush pollster, found that for American women, more free time was their single number one priority. And in 2008, there was a Pew Research study of the American middle class, which found that for a middle class household, more free time was the number one priority. And since work time reduction increases hourly productivity, it would be great for businesses. Now, let's be realistic. Most employers are not going to look kindly on work time reduction. But they're going to have to soon enough because of the millennials. That's one thing. And second, if unions would finally go back to their roots and return to the issue that originally inspired workers to organize, they would make work time reduction happen, and it would make the system work on its own terms. I did want to come back to Naomi Klein. What time is it anyway? There's a pause here. It's about 2. What, did I leave too much time for comments? Mike Underco. Go ahead. Oh, Jay took off. You know, it's so nice to have an expert in the audience, and I looked over to Jay to see if he could respond to this. I'm honestly not in a position to answer that. But Mike, my student, asked an excellent question. Could urban farming be counted on to, you know, to feed millions of people who live in the cities? Anybody? Russell, do you have any comment on this? Because I know you're interested in food issues. And let me repeat what you said. You know, I'm going to compare the meat-based diet to vegetarian. In that case, that it will be a multiple of 6, 18 compared to 3. Am I right? I think. Okay. Russell Barefoot just explained that it takes 6 times the acreage of crops per person for a meat-based diet compared to per capita using a vegetarian diet.
And then it would be one-sixth of that, or less than one-sixth of that, one-sixth of an acre for completely meat.
for completely vegan, less than a sixth of an acre. Let me just say this. If you let the market for urban agriculture be satisfied, because we know there's a market, we see it growing, right? If we let that market be satisfied, for sure more people would discover plant-based foods, because you're not going to have, you know, cattle on the range in the city, right? That's one thing. Oh, let me add this. I know there's a growing trend to have farm-to-school lunch servings in the schools. And we've discovered that students will choose healthier meals if it's fresh and good tasting. In other words, the farm-to-school project has been very successful. So I'm not giving you a definitive response, but I'm saying it's possible to introduce people to different types of diets. And if we do shift more to a plant-based diet, it will at least partly address the concern you raised. To what extent can we feed people with urban agriculture? If you expand it to local agriculture, I'm sure it's possible.
What the real question is, I'm not sure if I'm...
Mike's original question was, could we really feed millions of, you know, urban dwellers with urban agriculture? Perhaps not, but again, you do have a ring of suburbs and exurbs around urban areas, right? And this, I guess the suburbs still have some farms. Elaine, speak up.
Okay, we're talking about eating low on the food chain, and you're aware of the project I've given my advertising class. What about going to an insect-based diet, like a majority of the world does, where they're getting their protein from insects, and there are a lot of companies that are now working at doing insect-based protein powders to use to feed the masses.
You know what? Yeah. I'm open-minded, but I'm not going to go... Oh, you know what? Again, for the sake of the podcast, Elaine Moore, the marketing professor, said she was giving her marketing students a project. Could we market insect-based agriculture here in the States? And we should mention there are countries that, you know... Elaine Moore just added a large portion of the world uses insect protein as their protein source. Oh, thank you for saying consumption, consumption, consumption. Can I take your last look? You brought up a few things here. And I'm going to take your last point first, and it's and this is somewhere in my notes, and I'm so glad you brought it up. I would have been disappointed if I didn't bring up that last point. Let me, for the sake of the podcast, let me try to sum up what you just said, right? Lauren Braun, a professor of history, pointed out that there's some cultural themes going on here. The rest of the world is aspiring to a middle-class lifestyle, which is requiring a lot more energy use. She was – obviously, this can be problematic, and she was saying, can economics address this concern? I'll tell you what. Rather than going to the consumption issue right away, which I do want to do, let me start by repeating that existing values right now in this country are creating markets that involve, well, less consumption, right? It might not be sufficient just to satisfy those markets. But, you know, we could highlight the eminent convenience of those lifestyles. It drives me up a wall when I hear people saying we have to confront an inconvenient truth. I told you, I walk to the train. On the train, I get the best time to read. On the train, I sometimes join Ronald Tyson. We've had the greatest conversations, much better than the conversations you have while you're texting and driving. So culturally, we could highlight the utter convenience of this lifestyle, all right? I'll get to you in a minute. This is important. I want to add something. Lauren Braun, I want you all to hear this because this is an interesting thought. Seriously, Lauren Braun pointed out that aspiring to a middle-class values, maybe even capitalism pushes consumption. We forget that if you go back to traditional, what's the word I'm looking for? Traditional economic thought, old-fashioned traditional economic thought, the belief was that we had to teach the masses how to defer gratification and consume less. Consuming less used to be a conservative idea. And in a recent book called Unstoppable by Ralph Nader, he talks about some conservative writers, conservative experts, who are saying conservatism should not embrace all-out consumerism. So I wish Bill Klinger was here. He was saying with his financial advice for retirement, the trick is to consume less and put something aside, right? That was the old-fashioned idea. It goes together with modern environmentalism, which says we've got to stop so much consumption. Now, there was something else I want to add to this. Tom, I know you had your hand up, but there's something else I want to add to this, namely that by consuming less, we're not necessarily sacrificing. If you set up an efficient lifestyle, you have higher material well-being. Tom, speak. Go ahead.
I still just can't ever imagine, like, you know, no offense, just like, you know, eating all these
You said something about freedom. Look, let me try to summarize your point. Tom Mesters is saying we in the richer countries are not about to give up our material comforts and our high quality of life, something to that effect. He can't imagine adapting and eating an insect-based diet. And Tom was saying he likes to go to the supermarket and buy filet mignon. Under this scenario, you would be free to buy a filet mignon. You'd have to pay for it because in reality, it's expensive. It takes a lot of resources that you're not paying for when you eat it. Yeah, Andrea Vaccaro just pointed out that we subsidize corn, and if we didn't subsidize corn and monocultures, steak would be that much more expensive. By the way, that's why in Europe, it's not typical to have a big slab of meat at a meal. I know in the Mediterranean diets, meat is often used as a as part of the meal, but not the main. What's the word I'm looking for? To supplement the meal. And it's a very healthy diet, the Mediterranean diet. And let me repeat. You were saying you don't see how us in the richer countries could adapt to a more environmentally beneficial lifestyle. But look. You go to a fancy restaurant and it says this produce is fresh and was grown in our garden. Everybody's, ooh, such fancy stuff. In my lifestyle, which takes fewer resources and involves less consumption of resources, you're eating fresh produce from next door or from the rooftops, literally, which is the case in some cities. So I am definitely talking about a higher quality of life, higher material well-being. In my lifestyle, you're not going to be stuck in traffic. Higher quality of life. Oh, let me add this. In the lifestyle I'm describing, it's going to be a substantial reduction in the incidence of chronic disease. Tell Carl, if we substantially reduce the incidence of chronic disease, it will reduce the amount of production or amount of goods and services in the medical industry. But it's higher material well-being. And there are a lot of corporations that are desperately seeking to reduce the incidence of chronic disease to reduce their healthcare costs. So that's consistent with capitalism. Could I ask why you're smiling, Philip? Oh, okay. Thought... I put you on the spot. Okay. You seem to really relate to my talking about reducing the incidence of chronic disease. All right. Well, I think these were superb points. And I think my students really contributed to this discussion. And that makes me very, very happy. And I'm going to write a newspaper column about my students, which is not a joke. Well, thanks so much for showing up. Did you like the food? That drives home the whole point. If, for the sake of the podcast, it was vegan food.